You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 12th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. It's 1900 in Beijing, 1400 in Jerusalem, midday here in London and 4am in Seattle. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme:
תקיפה משטח איראן תהווה הוכחה ברורה על הכוונות האיראניות להסלים את המזרח התיכון ולהפסיק להסתתר מאחורי השלוחים.
An Israeli military spokesman confirms Israel is prepared both defensively and offensively if Iran were to attack. We look at the US attempts at deterrence. Then we'll hear about Olaf Scholz's visit to China in the hopes of bolstering Germany's faltering economy. Plus, we'll discuss Europe's battle with populism at the Delphi Economic Forum, and we'll hear about Paris's new Olympic Museum.
The idea is really to make the connections between these values of the Olympism and these new sports, and really the links with the urban space.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. It's been 11 days since Israel reportedly struck Iran's consulate in Syria, killing 13 people. Now, in a sign of how serious the threat of retaliation is being taken, the United States has restricted travel for its embassy employees in Israel amid fears of an attack. They've been instructed not to travel out of the Jerusalem, Tel Aviv and Beersheba area out of an abundance of caution. Israel has not claimed responsibility for the strike, but is widely considered to have been behind it. The United States, the UK and others are urging Iran against further escalation, which could lead to a full regional war. We'll discuss this. We're joined now by Paul Rogers, Open Democracy's international security expert. Paul, thank you for being on the show. Firstly, how serious a threat is it at the moment of retaliation by Iran?
It's very difficult to tell. The indications are that Iran is intent on doing something. It's what that counts. The issue is, as you say, 11 days ago, this strike on the consulate, part of the Iranian diplomatic compound in essentially in Syria, and that obviously killed two senior people and killed several others. So it's an attack on a diplomatic compound. Now, that, in a sense, it leaves Iran in a position where, as it doesn't react, it seems to be a sign of weakness. So it's quite possible they will. The idea, I think, that the Americans are concerned about, at Iran doing a direct attack on Israel, personally, I think is unlikely. But you may well find a kind of tit-for-tat attack against an Israeli diplomatic center somewhere else in the world. That, at least, is possible. But as I say at the start, this is unpredictable. The one thing is, if there was an attack on an Israeli diplomatic compound, one thinks back, what is it, 40, 42 years to the start of the Lebanon War back in 1982, when the Israeli ambassador in London was assassinated. No, he wasn't assassinated. He was very seriously injured and never fully recovered. And that led to the Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon. It was given as the reason for actually precipitating it at that time. So there would be an Israeli reaction, but the risk of this going to some sort of all-out regional war, well, the reality is the United States does not want that. Iran doesn't want that. Israel, on the other hand, I think wants to at least up the ante, because this is an extraordinary diversion from what's been going on in Gaza. I mean, you know, this was, what, 11, 12 days ago. If you go a fortnight ago, then the American attitude to Israel was very, very critical on the side of Gaza. Now it's almost as though there's been a complete change, and America is saying we will back Israel to the hilt. So it's a strange situation we are in, but the reality is there is the danger. But I think most people reckon the Iranians will not go hugely against Israel because they do not want a wider war.
I mean, if Israel was to come under direct attack from Iran, what would we be talking about? Would it be a missile strike? Would it be planes bombarding the country? I mean, what could they tangibly do?
Well, the Israelis have have a wide range of options. Iran does have pretty competent air defences. But on the other hand, the Israelis have, they think they have state-of-the-art stuff. They have the F-15I in particular and the new F-35, and they would be difficult to counter. So I think you would be looking at airstrikes. The one thing which I think is worrying some specialists, and in my view rightly, is whether the Israelis would use any kind of attack from Iran as a reason for going for the Iranian nuclear weapons program. Now, we don't know how far that advanced that is. They're certainly not at the stage of having nuclear weapons, but they appear to want to get pretty close to it and then hold at that point. Now, if Israel was actually to try and do an attack on that, which would be very difficult, but they could perhaps do it, then that is when I think you would get really very dangerous escalation. One wouldn't expect that from the Israelis, but then, you know, the cost of the Gaza war, 33,000 people killed and the rest, indicates that Netanyahu's state will go a long way in pursuit of its security requirements, so to speak.
And, you know, there's been much criticism of Benjamin Netanyahu even before the 7th of October, but particularly of late, for continuing the war, the cost of it, the bloodshed, and it being part in his own interest, given the troubles that he faces if he were to be removed from office legally. Do you think that he is, you know, despite all the calls for winding things down, do you think he might actually want something to happen to make a strong attack on Iran?
I really don't know, and I think it's a question that is worrying a lot of American diplomats, because he is pretty unpredictable. He is an extraordinary survivalist, and for most Israeli leaders, you would not really anticipate this kind of action. On the other hand, while he is pretty unpopular, there remains pretty strong support among Israelis for the pursuit of the war. And that would include, I think, also pursuit of any sort of campaign against Iran. So I think Netanyahu is quite capable of taking this a long way to ensure his own survival. And he feels he has enough support from enough Israelis on this issue, if not on others, to make it worth his while. So this, I think, is one of the reasons why you're getting the United States and indeed Arab ambassadors across the Middle East saying to Iran, hold back, do not do this. And I suspect the Iranians will take a middle path. It's a question of whether that is enough to allow Netanyahu to expand the whole situation. And I fear it may not be enough.
You've already touched on this, but President Biden coming out and declaring ironclad support for Israeli defence is a bit of a gear shift from the message over the preceding week, where he did start to say that, you know, support wouldn't be unconditional. He's tried to pull them back from the south of Gaza. Do you think that that shows genuine fear from the White House that this could be starting to get out of control? They've been worried about this wider regional war since October 7th. But do you think we're closer now than at any point since that date?
I think that that's a large part of it. But the other factor which people outside the United States have to appreciate is that, you know, the concern that the Americans have about Iran goes right back to the hostage crisis, right at the end of the Carter administration, you know, long, long time ago. And essentially, that's, if, you know, when the diplomats were held hostage for, what was it, 444 days, I think, it cost Carter certainly his re-election, and Reagan came in instead. But essentially, it's basically rooted in the American foreign policy experience as a disaster. And this is one of the reasons why they are particularly concerned with Iran, which is a measure of the fact they're going to great lengths this time to try and prevent any further escalation. So it's a mixed message. But yes, the Americans take this rather more seriously than many people, I think, in other parts of the world realize.
Paul, thank you. That was Paul Rogers. Now here's Carlotta Ribello with today's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. A large power plant near Kyiv has been destroyed by a Russian missile strike. Power facilities across Ukraine were also affected by attacks, raising fresh fears about the country's energy systems. Volodymyr Zelensky has launched an appeal to Western allies for more aerial support. Thailand's foreign minister is set to visit a border town near Myanmar after days of clashes between the military government's troops and ethnic minority armed groups. The fighting has displaced hundreds of residents, with a further influx expected in the coming weeks. And a Portuguese man has become the first European citizen jailed under the China-imposed national security law in Hong Kong. Joseph John, also known as Wong King Chung, holds a Portuguese passport and Hong Kong residency and was previously based in the UK. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thanks, Carlotta. And now to Germany, where tomorrow Chancellor Olaf Scholz starts a high-stakes visit to China in the hope of shoring up ties. But he'll have a delicate line to balance, with the US and EU both threatening to hammer Chinese goods in a row over subsidies. Isabel Hilton, founder of China Dialogue and visiting professor at King's College London's Lau Institute, joins us now. Isabel, this will be Scholz's longest trip abroad since assuming the chancellorship. Why is he going to China now?
Well, he has a lot of problems at home. His coalition is pretty fractious. It's a traffic light coalition, always hard to maintain, even in good times. And he is personally very unpopular. The German economy, the great engine of European prosperity in the post-war era, is frankly in trouble. And a lot of that trouble is coming from China. So, and in addition to the geostrategic tensions that you mentioned, so the United States trying to punish China quite hard, Germany is dependent on the United States both for markets and for defense, and it's also dependent on China. So he's in a very tricky position. With China's unpopularity in Europe, he's trying to walk a line which gives greater opportunity to German manufacturers and German businesses whilst presenting himself as being suitably and appropriately stern with China over the subsidy of its own industry, over the overproduction and the threat of dumping. It's a tricky trip.
And just on those economic ties, firstly, between China and Germany, what are the issues in the relationship there?
Well, the great Germany's been the huge beneficiary of China's growth because it had what China wanted. It had enormous expertise in the kind of engineering that China needed to become the world's factory. And Germany was the only country in Europe, it still is the only country in Europe, that runs a trade surplus with China. But over the last 5-6 years, that great opportunity has begun to shrink as China's own capacity has grown in sophistication. And as China has moved into the areas of new technology, which are not Germany's strength. So Germany did very well when China was booming in steel, in cement, in you know, chemicals, all of that. Germany had enormous expertise in Volkswagen. Sold most of its cars in China and was producing enormous numbers in China. But those were petrol cars. Now China is a global leader in electric vehicles and is coming back at Volkswagen, into Volkswagen's home market, but also into third markets where German business has also traditionally flourished. So they're getting a double whammy. The opportunity that China presented, which was so good for them for so long, is shrinking. And they're being challenged in areas that of expertise that China has built up and Germany has neglected.
And you've touched on this, but, you know, Germany's legacy automakers are facing stiff competition from rising EV makers like BYD and NIO. There's concerns Europe will be flooded with cheap and heavily subsidised Chinese vehicles that could dominate this future market. I mean, how is Scholz trying to handle this? Because there is, you know, the threat that the US and the EU might block these cars or put tariffs on them entering the market. Is that something that would obviously benefit Germany but might impact the relationship between the two nations?
Well, that's exactly his dilemma, because in fact, it was the French who were very keen to get the European Commission to open the investigation into the subsidies of cars, which are pretty eye-watering. And we have an overproduction situation in China, which means that there's price slashing going on. So Chinese cars could come into the European market at 10,000 euros less than a European manufacturer could offer a vehicle. So that's, you know, that's pretty brutal. And it is. And partly because Chinese industry is efficient, but it is also undoubtedly because of massive subsidies. So the French were very keen that this be exposed and that barriers be put up. The Germans were far less keen because they have far more at stake. They can anticipate, you know, retaliatory measures against their businesses. So the giant chemical company BASF, which has enormous projects in China, the car companies, which still have projects in China. And there's a dependency. Germany has been trying to reduce its dependency on certain sectors. There are about 90 supply chains which depend heavily on China. And it hasn't really worked. You know, they've reduced the dependency on some things, but then they've added new lines. So they're a bit stuck because if they offend China too much, a bad situation could get quite dramatically worse. And China knows this. China will be, you know, Xi Jinping will be telling Scholz, you know, you have to rein in the European Union or things could go quite badly.
And one thing in particular here, for, given you know Germany's history in the 20th century, the accusations, you know, from multiple human rights groups that China is operating, in effect, sort of concentration camps with Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang, is something that really can't be ignored. But do you think Olaf Scholz will be willing to take a risk and bring it up, given Germany's own history with these camps?
I think he will bring it up in the usual formulaic way. I think Western political leaders who go to China do have to mention it, but we can be fairly confident that this will not be the first item on the agenda and that no other agenda items will depend on the response. I think the exchanges on human rights with China have degenerated into position statements and really not much else. He will do that because he'll be asked about it and he'll have to be able to say that, yes, he did it, but it won't be top of his list. Much more important, and probably more important, to be fair to the German public at this point, are questions of market access in China, the relationship with Russia. You know, that is another big headache for Scholz, given that Germany's relationship with Russia was among, again, the closest in Europe. The dependency on Russian gas was enormous. The shock of the war in Ukraine was severe and is still reverberating through the German economy. And Xi Jinping is the enabler of Russia in the war in Ukraine. So, you know, that, it again, is an issue that one might expect him to bring up, but I suspect it'll be rather hedged about.
Isabel Hilton, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. To Greece now, where the Delphi Economic Forum is wrapping up this weekend. Monocle's team on the ground has been exploring the rising challenge of populism in Europe and whether Greece's own emergence from crisis in just 10 years holds lessons for other countries. Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke with Greek political scientist and author Takis Pappas and began by asking if there's a reason why some countries are more prone to populism than others.
Greece is the country in which populism grew very, very strong. That was the first country in post-war Europe in which populism came into power. That was back in 1981, and that was a left kind of populism. And we have had a recurrence of populist phenomena in Greece, in this country, by both left and right-wing governments or coalitions like, you know, Syriza and the independent Greeks more recently. Now, what do you have there in all of the cases of populism if you ask for one common denominator is charismatic leadership. You always have a leader who is charismatic. Now, the thing is, how do you define charisma? That is easy again, because all charismatic leaders or all populist charismatic leaders have either had a party of their own or conquered a party, like Trump, for example.
Sure.
So they, all of them have a party which they use in order to capture power and then exercise power. So charisma, agency, leadership is the vital characteristic of all populist movements or parties, no exception.
Is leadership ever an antidote to populism, though? Because this will not be a new idea to you, but there has been a lot of suggestion that the government of Kyriakos Mitsotakis here has served as kind of an antidote to populism, possibly a template for how it can be pushed back against. I interviewed Mitsotakis a couple of months ago in Munich. He did slightly waspishly say that he had the advantage that in Greece the populists had been allowed to govern, and he was able to demonstrate that instead here is what actual competence looks like.
Yes, there is a template, actually. But let me go back to populism. What is populism? What do we mean by that? By populism, I mean a leader who promises to his people, usually it is men. I mean, we're talking about men. Mm-hmm. I mean, all populist leaders who have governed are men. You don't have women, as far as I know. Now, those people promise their people to rule their countries, disrespecting the institutions, serving the interest of the people. That is the main idea. So the main idea of populism is a leader who rules even against the institutions. Now, the template for a non-populist, a moderate, a liberal leader to emerge is to stick to the institutions, okay, and promise that he is going to do the job by sticking to the institutions, essentially, and he has to convince the people to vote for him. Because, let us not forget that, populists are not non-democrats, they're democrats, okay? They play by the rules of the electoral game. So the distinction here is between those leaders who play by the institutions and those who play against the institutions, illiberal democracy, hence populism.
I mean, does it surprise you, though, that the appeal is recurrent, that there does always seem to be a market for it? Because the record of populists of any sort of actually being able to govern when they win elections is, well, it's fairly slender. They usually get into power, screw everything up, blame everybody else, and then get turfed out of power until they come back again. But they always do seem to find a way to come back. There's always an appetite for it.
They do. Of course, there is always an appetite for it because, you know, people do not like the institutions. The institutions require from you to be a responsible citizen. Who wants that, after all? I mean, look at the United States. So populism is a recurrent phenomenon since the 19th century. You always have that at the regional level, at the state level, at the national level, until Trump, of course. So once you have a populist situation or a populist regime or a populist government in a state like Greece, for example, there's a memory of that. And usually that memory is not a bleak memory. It's a fond memory. People remember that period as a period in which, you know, the people did whatever they wanted, actually. So this is why in Greece, for example, the Greek people remember very fondly the 80s. Okay, the period under the leadership of Andreas Papandreou. But that was the period in which, you know, growth was the most sluggish in Greece. Okay, but people think about that period very, very fondly, and, you know, they remember that period. And they say it was one of the best periods in our lives as a nation, as a people, etc., etc. So there is an appeal to populism. There is some magic there.
Well, on that thought, then, we're about to see another test case of this with the upcoming EU elections. Polls, various analyses, one I was reading by the European Council on Foreign Relations thinks that populist slash far-right parties will probably come first in at least 9 countries. And does that strike you as a cause for genuine concern? Would they be in a position to do considerable damage in the time that they have in power, or at least enough of a presence in the European Parliament to make enough noise?
Yes, clearly. Clearly, but this will be policy noise, not political noise necessarily. Well, political noise as well. But those parties which you find on the extreme, what we call extreme right, is a bunch of parties which, first of all, cannot cooperate between them. Okay, there are many, many divisions between those parties. And secondly, those are not parties that want to overthrow the liberal democracies and the liberal democratic systems in their countries, or the liberal constitutions. They do not run against the constitutions. Populist parties always run against the constitution. Populist leaders, when they come into power, they change the constitution or amend the constitution. That is a rule. I've seen that everywhere in all countries that I have studied, and I've studied many. The extreme right parties and the leaders, both men and women there, we have many women there, are not populists in the technical sense, the one that I have tried to explain here. They do not run against the liberal constitution or the liberal institutions. They want to change the policies, especially in terms of migration and European integration. So those are anti-migration parties, clearly, and anti-European EU parties, if you like. So I call those parties nativist parties because they are for the native. I mean, they want a liberal democracy, but for the native people, their people, okay? They don't want foreigners, and they, foreigners, both non-Europeans and Europeans. They don't want Greeks, for example, okay? Or Portuguese or Italians in their economies, necessarily. So they're nationalist nativist parties. I mean, that is the term that I think describes better those extreme right parties, quote unquote extreme right. So in that sense, yes, they do, they will play a very significant political role in the sense that they're going to try to change the some of the major policy sets in Europe, in the European Union, particularly those, as I said, concerning migration, further European integration, labor laws, free movement of citizens, etc., etc.
Andrew Müller with Takis Pappas there. Thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Four years after sport climbing, BMX, surfing and skateboarding were introduced at the Tokyo Games, breakdancing will enjoy its first Olympic appearance in Paris this summer, a reflection of the International Olympic Committee's desire to make the Games more artistic, youth-focused and urban. Breakdancing, known as le breaking, represents the first Olympic dance sport discipline. A new interactive exhibition in the French capital, Spot 24, spotlights the exciting addition to the Games and the widen urban culture. Monocle's Claudia Jacob paid a visit to the exhibition curated by the Paris Tourism Office and heard more from its director, Corinne Ménageur.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the World Breaking Championship.
The idea was really to, you know, highlight some Olympic disciplines, which are the new ones at the Games of 2024, like the break, of course, but everything about linked, I would say, to urban sports mostly. The idea is really to make the connections between these values of the Olympism and these new sports. And moreover, I would say, which is really important to me, is really the links with the urban space, because we're a big city like Paris. Having some sports in the city is always a challenge, but we also have a real tradition of urban culture in Paris.
Located at the foot of the Eiffel Tower in the 7th arrondissement, the exhibition's central location will be at the core of the city's Olympic venues. In the spirit of reusing existing buildings for the Games, the industrial venue feels apt, given the urban connotations of breakdancing.
It's not only the monumental city that we know, the museum city that we know, but it also is a city where people live, practice sports, do some arts, live in the street, and the street culture is part of our everyday, I would say, life. And so the idea was really to use this position because it's at the heart of the touristic sector for the Eiffel Tower. Of course, we're on the way to the Eiffel Tower, but also because it's also in the center of the Olympic ecosystem in Paris, because you've got the Trocadéro with the Champions Park and the Concorde not very far away, the beach volley under the Eiffel Tower, the Seine, of course. So that was also important for us, just to be recognized as an iconic place. This exhibition is also a way of gathering the community together, being a central point for them. So I would love that Spot 24 becomes the, you know, the place to be for this urban community somewhere.
Inside the industrious-looking premises, I'm greeted by feature films showing punchy pieces of breakdancing improvisation. As a dance form that originated in the Bronx in the 1970s, breakdancing took off in Paris's suburbs in the 1980s, a sport which younger generations quickly bought into. At Spot 24, a breakdancing stage allows groups to hone their choreography, as hip-hop tracks blare in the background. Watching on, I can sense that Spot 24 isn't just an exhibition, but a hive of creative activity. As a significant breakdancing sponsor, a vibrant display of Nike trainers made me consider the competitors' footwear, which needs to be soft and flexible.
And of course, these Olympics, we're really aiming at make them very inclusive, very popular. They are in the heart of the city. And I think this is very different from a sport competition, normal sport competition, usual sport competition, I would say. The idea is really to make a real entertainment around sport. And of course, urban culture was really a link and a very high value for Paris.
The immersive exhibition put together by François Gautret, curator of the Hip Hop 360 exhibition, which appeared at the Paris Philharmonic in 2022, attracts gaming enthusiasts through interactive video games. Breakdancing-themed bandes dessinées, or comic strips, reminded me of the cultural influence of breakdancing, which has infiltrated the country's literature, art, fashion and design. Prestigious artefacts, including the Olympic torches from the Rio and Tokyo Games, borrowed from the Olympic Museum in Lausanne, celebrate the urban sports which had their debut at their games.
We came to meet with the Museum of Lausanne, the Olympic Museum, and I was very impressed by the exhibition that they had. They already had a work on the skateboarding, essentially, and surf last year as a temporary exhibition in their museum. And so the idea was really how we could leverage what they did and include that in a much wider exhibition that we wanted to produce.
I can sense a palpable anticipation as Parisians gear up for a summer which will go down in sporting history. Named Spot 24, the exhibition hopes to become a meeting point for these urban sporting communities.
Because it's always the place, the location where you gather the community when you go to practice. So it's the spot for the basket, the spot for the break, the spot for the surf, which is a vague wave, but of course for all sports. And so that was probably the common word that they all use. And so that was very recognizable. And of course, 24, because it's our lucky number, I would say, for this year.
That was Claudia Jacob in conversation with Karine Ménageur. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Lily Austin. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.